Backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. It's Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. We have a moderate danger again today, and unfortunately, we're kind of in a holding pattern. The persistent weak layers of faceted snow in our snowpack. Persistent slab avalanches remain possible. The latest one was on Sunday, and for the snowpack to heal, it's just going to need more time. Warm temperatures are helping, but they also create a moderate danger for some very small loose wet avalanches on south aspects today. So with that said, make sure you check UtahAvalancheCenter.org every day before you head out.
Okay. Hey, thanks. Summit County and the Park City Chamber Bureau last week reached a new agreement detailing how revenues from transient room taxes will be distributed over the next 10 years. In the studio to explain and what it means for both the county and the Chamber of Visitors Bureau, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher along with Chamber Bureau Director Bill Malone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Tom, let's have you just start and give us the overview. These transient room tax funds in the last 10 years have basically grown significantly.
They have. So just to recap, in 2012, we were collecting just around $5.6 million. 2016, we were upwards about $8.7 million. And just looking at the revenues for 2017, we're up above $10 million. So they have grown significantly, which is a testament to our economy and how well it's doing. But it certainly also changed the thought process around it over the last year.
So was it that finding that triggered the county then to investigate?
Well, I think it's a lot of things. If you kind of look it back at what the council has done over the last 2 years with transient room tax, at least the 10% that it's been retaining in the past, you look at the Oakley River project or the fairgrounds or even Bonanza Flat. And there's a change in or a kind of an attitude forming of what some hard assets could be that would encourage more tourism in the future in Summit County and all over Summit County. So I think that's some of the thought process that went into this and some of the impetus of what you've seen over the last few months.
Yeah, Bill, and of course you saw the numbers come in. I mean, did this come as any surprise to you that the county was interested in renegotiating?
Well, yeah, it did. You know, we had an agreement and that was, I believe, re-signed in 2011. And so we knew we had a few years left on the current agreement. However, that agreement always had the ability for either party to kind of raise the flag 1 year in advance and say, hey, we want to renegotiate this. So when that occurred in June, you know, we knew, okay, the county's interested in spending more of the dollars on hard assets and tourism-related amenities. And so we went into it at that point and kind of looked for a way to do it. We understand it's set up that way in the legislation. Up to one-third can be used and bonded for those types of projects. So it wasn't totally surprising, but you know, I thought it was a good process in terms of how we got to where we got.
Right. So the contract ended about 3 years earlier than it would have.
Correct. And we renewed a new contract for a 10-year period.
All right. So a committee was formed then, what, just as a way to be a little bit more objective about it rather than just the two interested parties?
Well, I think, you know, we both have bosses that we go back to. And I think the fact of bringing them and having representatives from our organizations at the table, and it gives more eyeballs on it. And I think just a better outcome in terms of not just two people sitting there trying to hash out the numbers.
Exactly.
So who was on the committee?
So from the county's perspective, it was Kim Carson and Chris Robinson, and then staff was Janie Young and myself.
And then on the Chamber Bureau side was Chris Eggleton from the Lodging Association, Sarah Werbelow, our chairperson this year, and Bob Wheaton from Deer Valley Resort, along with myself.
All right. So, Bill, when you – I mean, to see these numbers climb, I mean, from $5.5 million to almost $10 million, I mean – what have you been doing with the money?
Well, obviously, good things.
Agreed. That's one of the reasons it's growing.
Right. Getting people in hotel rooms,
yes.
Basically.
Yes.
Right?
And, you know, we've had – now, obviously, those numbers have a lot to do with occupancy, but they have a heck of a lot to do with rate. And so when you see properties coming on board and hitting their stride in terms of the luxury hotels in our community, you saw the numbers go up significantly over that time. And then you look at what's being built, and much of it is in the luxury realm as well. Stein Residences, properties like that that generate very large nightly rental rates, which in turn create big numbers for transient room tax.
Right. And do you also get money from the VRBOs and Airbnbs, or
well, you don't know? We do from Airbnb. Airbnb does collect taxes on their bookings, and that has been a significant number as well in the county. We do not from other rent-by-owner sources. It's left up to the owner of that property to file taxes. It's not the website that conducts the transaction. So in some cases we are collecting taxes, and in others we're not, that are going under the radar screen. But the entire rent by owner phenomenon has also added dollars to the transient room tax collections.
So under the new agreement, the county will eventually retain 30% of the funds, while the Chamber Bureau will receive the other 70. The agreement goes into effect in July, and we're going to take a gradual transition to the new split, going from 10 to 17% this first year for the county, 83 for the chamber, then moving it to a 24-76 split in 2019, and then before hitting that 30-70 distribution in 2020. So why was that tiered approach important to you, Bill?
Well, it was very important to us to kind of create a glide path on this, to be able to go back and not dismantle everything that we've been doing with a significant cut in transient room tax. So this allows us to, we kind of refer to it as we can adjust the budget with a scalpel instead of a chainsaw approach to this. The other two things that were important to the Chamber Bureau, in addition to kind of a glide path to get to that 70-30, was maintaining a percentage split. It's just kind of who we are. It's our DNA. It's a performance-driven process. You're putting stuff out there. Is it working? Measuring in that way. And so it still maintains that ability for our staff and our organization to look at what we're doing and is it working. And the third part is the length of the contract. We're, still signing long-term agreements. We have a long-term agreement with Sundance Film Festival to be a host community. Same things with other events that we're looking at a couple years down the road. And the ability to kind of know where we are down the road in those years is very, very important so that we can secure those types of events, make long-term agreements as it relates to things such as possibly Olympics in the future. Long-term media buys, those types of things help us out.
Well, and the interesting part about that is that those three things the group agreed upon right away while we were talking. So it made the rest of it really easy.
Yeah.
So given the growth that we have seen in the transient room tax, I mean, will the chamber even be impacted in 3 years? And by how much?
We're obviously very concerned about the rest of this winter. Right now. So we're watching that very closely in terms of what impact that has on transient room tax collections. But if we look at it, there's a dip of several hundred thousand dollars each year, kind of in a forecast and trying to project what is the actual growth, during that time in taking into account the change in percentage. I kind of see it as a little bit of a hockey stick. It kind of goes down a little bit each year for 3 years and then should start coming back up with new product in the market. There's new product coming out of the ground at the Canyons projects, things such as the hotel at Blue Sky Ranch, those types of things that are coming on the market. So I think that's going to add more to the tax while we're changing that percentage. So I have a feeling, we'll probably see a change of maybe 10%, I think, each of these years.
And is that easy to manipulate in your budget? You just don't run ads?
We'll have to look at possibly markets. We're currently, our television campaign right now is in you know, Houston and Washington, D.C. and Boston and San Francisco and L.A. and Chicago. And maybe we have to eliminate some of those markets as to where we go. Or we may have to make some changes to different areas in terms of where we spend those dollars, special events, sponsorships of that. Things like that we may have to readjust. These are all things that our board will look at the retreat in April and kind of give us direction as to where they want us to absorb those changes in the coming year.
So what's your message this year, given the low snow year?
Oh, boy, we're out.
Come anyway?
Yeah, lots to do. In addition to skiing, it's a challenging winter right now, and obviously we're more concerned about on the spring skiing side of it, and so we're still plowing away, trying to. Every storm helps, but these long periods of time, we know we're losing some customers,
right?
During that period,
and without the base, that's what you're worried about.
Yeah.
It when the sun turns, it melts. Yeah. In terms of Tom, what you had said, it could go up to, the county can take up to how much? 33%, 35%?
They can take up to 1/3 or 30%, according to state law. So this puts us close to that, but not to the full third.
Okay. And any idea what that means then in terms of money you'll see come in?
Yeah, so I mean it's pretty easy to calculate each year. If we were collecting in 2017 just over $10 million, if we matched that in Bill's 2018 budget year, we'd be collecting about $3 million per year, which then translates into what is the county going to do with that money in the future? And the council hasn't totally decided that or the method yet, but there's a lot of things out there that they're looking at. I mentioned before looking at the recent past of some open space participation, agricultural preservation, the assets around the fairgrounds itself as indicators of what's going on. But the planning effort around arts, beauty, and culture that went on and is still finishing up as far as their implementation phase. That's another thing I think the council will be looking at and the community will be looking at.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to add about that?
No.
I've got nothing else.
Okay. Hey, Bill and Tom, thanks for your time this
morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:39. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, every 2 years, the state of Utah conducts what's called the Student Health and Risk Prevention Study, known as SHARP. That was done last year. The results just released for 2017. In the studio with me to talk a little bit about those findings and what that means and how we deal with the realities of the report, I have Mary Krista Smith. She's the coordinator of Summit County's Communities at Care, along with Steve White, the board's chairman. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Mary Krista, let's just start with a little bit of background. You were hired last year to lead this local Communities That Care, a new organization for Summit County, but something that's been around nationally for a while.
Yes, the Summit County Mental Wellness Alliance was formed in 2017, and one of the strategic goals of the alliance is to provide education and prevention for youth, and especially in relationship to mental health and substance abuse. And it was recommended to utilize the Communities That Care model and process that's been used nationwide to help communities make collective decisions around prevention through tested and effective programs. So it's part of the Mental Wellness Alliance, specifically targeting prevention and education for youth.
All right. So tell me how that works then. Steve, you're the chair of Communities that Care?
Yes, ma'am. So one of the things that is exciting about this particular program is the community-based relationship with prevention. What we're working to do is to generate as broad a coalition within our community as we can possibly get, so that as an entire community, as Summit County, not as individual pieces of it, we're able to come together and come up with some broad solutions that will support treatment and other issues like that, but focus predominantly on the prevention so that we're able to get into the lives and activities and families early enough so that we're able to prevent mental wellness and other kinds of struggles that some of our youth face.
Mm-hmm. So how many people on the, is it a board or a committee or?
It's a little of all of the above, which is kind of one of the fun parts. There is some formal structure to it, obviously with a chair and a coordinator. But one of the things that's fun about it is the informal part, where we have approximately 30 who will show up to a particular committee meeting, and a broader coalition of folks who will show up when they're available for it, as time permits. So it's a pretty good collection of individuals representing all kinds of organizations within Summit County.
So you meet regularly?
Yes.
First Wednesday of the month? I mean, what is that schedule look like?
It's the third Monday of the month. And we have, to Steve's point, members of our local governments, both city and county, representation from all three school districts, both counselors, teachers, and members of their school boards, as well as our nonprofit partners, and simply parents and counselors and young people who also sit on our committee. So as Steve said, we try to have as broad of an input as we can, so we're collectively making decisions.
Yeah. So what decisions have you made, or what have you implemented then, and since you've been hired, Mary Krista?
So the process is we are in phase three of the Communities That Care process, which is essentially analyzing the data that is available, the SHARP data being the foundation of that. We also bring in other sources of public data to say, what are we seeing? We all have our gut feeling about what is important in the community, but this is a data-driven process. So we have analyzed the SHARP data along with other sources of public data to identify priority risk factors for focus. We know we can't focus on 20 things at one time. We have to narrow it down to 3 or 4 in order to be effective. And so we brought that back to our committee at the end of January, and they unanimously voted based on the presentation of the data work group to select 3 priority risk factors for focus. And then that helps us determine what resources are available already in the community that are addressing these risk factors, and then what are other programs that may need to be brought in where we have gaps.
So you're phase three of out of how many phases then?
Of 5 phases. Then we select programs and implement and review and evaluate those programs going forward, and it just continues around the wheel again.
Yeah, so in terms of the priorities, you have identified those, or you're still working on
that? We have identified the priorities based on the data at our last meeting.
And what are those?
They are, and these are rather clinical sounding terms from the SHARP data, but the first is perceived risk of drug use. And what that essentially means is that young people are reporting that they do not see a risk in using, particularly e-cigarettes, alcohol, marijuana, that the sense is, well, it's legal. Well, it's not as harmful as some other things. What's the big deal? So there's this actually lack of perceived risk. That's the first one. The second risk factor that we're seeing is an increase in depressive symptoms. We're calling that mental health. But we're seeing greater suicidal ideation, greater incidence of self-harm, greater reporting of anxiety and depression among our young people, and it's trending up. The third risk factor that we see is parental attitudes. What young people are telling us is that when they are using specifically alcohol, that the most common place they are using, I believe it's close to 70% of those who reported drinking in the last 60 days reported drinking at home with their parents' permission. So there's a leniency that we're seeing in the data that the students are reporting that their parents are permissive when it comes to drinking in particular.
Yeah, so we do have the results of that SHARP, and I think you just got them, or you've had some time to look at them.
They were available to us. It was given in the spring of 2017 and made available early October. So we've been working hard since we received those results, along with other sources of public data through the health department, graduation rates. There are all kinds of studies by the CDC about how Utah ranks when it comes to suicide. We're in the top 5 in the country. So we take all of that into consideration in that report.
And Steve, are you a parent?
I am a parent. Yeah. I have a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old in the Park City school system.
Yeah. So when you looked at these results, anything that alarmed you?
A lot of the results alarmed me. It's one of the reasons that I'm part of this communities that care. It's consistent with the stories my kids bring home from school, friends who have parties at home where the underage drinking is kind of accepted and usually with very well-intentioned parents whose thought is often, I would rather, if my kids are going to drink, I'd rather they did it at home. And as part of that, just as one of the examples that Mary Krista used, as part of that, that then creates this perception within the kids that it actually is fine for them to do that. And so that's one of the reasons that we're pretty excited about what we're able to do creating this coalition is we can kind of address early on things like parent perception of what's going on with kids.
So sounds like we need as much work with the parents as we do with the kids. I mean, is that part of your focus?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Parent education and support and providing the resources for parents to be as effective as they can be within their families and to strengthen the lines of communication. It's tricky. You know, I have many friends who have young people same age as my daughter who's 15. It is not easy. People are struggling with these issues within their families and wanting to maintain positive relationships and communication with their young people and provide them some autonomy and draw clear boundaries. And anyone who's parented a teenager knows just how difficult that balance can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of just briefing the sharp results, it looked like some of those we have seen tick down since 2013, because that's what we saw, 2013, 15, and these results. But then at the same time, saw some spikes as well. And some of those, again, with alcohol use, and I guess it's just because it's the easiest to get?
The sharp data doesn't dig specifically into the rationale why, but yes, from my personal experience working and talking with folks in the community, yeah, one of the reasons I think alcohol spikes is because it's the easiest thing for kids to get access to, and that's particularly true when alcohol is a normal part of adult social life, fully accepted, and parents are, as Mary Krista said, parents are kind of struggling with how do you approach that when it's used in moderation in the home? How do you help your kids figure out what that means for kids? And so as part of that whole thing, I think, as you already mentioned, working with parents, working with families, and in partnership with places like the school districts is really where I think we're going to be able to see some difference.
Yeah. So what are the next steps then for your organization?
Key things for us is, as we now have identified the three of these key risk factors that we want to address, is to go in and evaluate resources that are already available so that we can maximize what is currently happening within Summit County. One of the things that we want to be careful of is that we're not just recreating the wheel or creating competing organizations or drawing funding and volunteers from organizations that are already effectively working. That's where the coalition comes in, is all of these organizations and individuals getting together and pooling resources and organizations. One of the things we'll look at is, are there gaps? Are there things that we do need to add? Or is it simply a matter of capitalizing on what already is available? Because there's some amazing organizations in Summit County doing very good work.
So, you know, as you mentioned, the study really doesn't delve into the why, but it seems to me that's pretty important. We know, of course, teenagers, experimentation is part of being a teenager.
Yeah.
But when we look at something beyond that, I mean, isn't that worth knowing why?
It absolutely is. And that is part of the next phase, the phase four, where we start to evaluate programs and looking at those drivers that are underneath the risk factors. So the risk factors are the dandelion heads at the surface. They're showing us there's a problem. In order to have effective programs that prevent the dandelion heads from coming to the surface, we have to get all the way into the root of what is actually underneath and driving those behaviors that we see in those risk factors. And so that will be a very interesting part of the process. And one I think we're all looking forward to is to get to that root cause and, You know, it's really about culture change, and this is not a simple solution. This is not one program that's going to happen in 5 years and solve all of our problems. There's not a unicorn we're going to bring in from outside to come and wave a magic wand and make this all go away. This is a collective effort that the school districts, the parents, the health department, coaches have all said, we see that there's this need in the community. We work with young people, and we recognize we've got some serious issues in Summit County around substance abuse and mental health. And no one entity can solve it themselves. And so hence the coalition was formed, because we know that the solutions lie here within the community, and that by working together, we can achieve the results that we're seeking, which is healthy, happy, engaged, thriving community members, especially our young people. That's our focus with Communities That Care.
Yeah. How are you going to measure that, though? Whether or not you've been successful?
Well, we're going to start with the SHARP data. It's interesting. This SHARP survey is given all across the country, and it is the foundational survey for Communities That Care. And so we start there, but we also look at supplementing that data with other sources. And it may be that we need to provide some additional data measurements as we go forward to make sure that we are truly measuring what we are seeking to measuring with those outcomes. And we will monitor those on an ongoing basis at least once a year to see, are we having an effect? Is it trending up or down? And what else is showing up that we need to be addressing?
Okay, I need to leave it there. Mary Krista Smith and Steve White with Communities That Care. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, on Saturday, the Park City Institute welcomes back author Anne Lamott in the studio to give us a preview of what to expect. The director of the Park City Institute, Terry Orr, good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you had Anne come speak when last?
I think it was 2002. But I want to back up a second, because before Anne, we have Lyle Lovett on Thursday night. We have a big week this
Sold
week.
Sold out, though, yeah?
Well, there's probably, yes, it really is, but there's probably about 10 seats left in the balcony. So if you're a diehard, and you know the balcony is a great seat in that theater, so we're pretty excited to have Lyle and Robert Earl Keane.
Okay, so just call the box office.
Call the box office, and yeah.
Okay.
So, yes, Anne is coming on Saturday, and we did have her, I think it was 2002. You know, we've had authors and speakers since we opened the Eccles Center in 98, so this is nothing new. But her star rose greatly. Not that she wasn't already a rock star in 2002, but she's done a lot more publishing of books, of writing for Salon, of all kinds of things, including a TED Talk last year.
Yeah. She's very entertaining. She's very funny, very spiritual, too. And I think that comes from her sobriety. And she writes and laughs about that in many of her books.
She's very authentic. I think that's the word when I think of her, both in person and in her writing. She is exactly as she writes. She appears the same way. She does talk about her sobriety, and it was hard won. She talks about her son, and she has some pretty funny stories about parenting. I remember one where she said she didn't understand why babies couldn't be like dogs. You could just leave a bowl of food out and they would take care of themselves and feed themselves and, you know, all of that. And I think anyone who parented a small child can relate to this is a lot of work.
That may have been an operating instructions.
It may have been. Yeah. And then, of course, Bird by Bird is a favorite of a lot of folks. Really came from a story about her brother who hadn't started a project about all these birds until the night before. And he was overwhelmed. And his father said, the way you do this is just start Bird by Bird. And
so
good advice.
So any idea what she has in mind for Saturday?
Well, we're doing an interview format, and then we'll do questions from the audience. So probably about 60 minutes of interview and then some questions from the audience.
Okay.
She will do book signing as well.
All right. Anything in particular that you want to know? I mean, have you started thinking about it?
Oh, yeah. I'm working on it. I'm working on it.
Well, and as we've mentioned, she's written a number of books. A particular favorite from you? Or?
Bird by Bird was significant for me. It really was, but certainly Operating Instructions and her latest Hallelujah Anyway is just pure Annie.
Okay. Tickets start at
$29, mm-hmm. and she's selling very well, but there are still tickets available in each section, each section.
Now, is it kid-friendly? Because you do offer the $5 student tickets.
It is, I think. You know, I think I don't think it's really something that would interest kids under junior high, but certainly junior high and up.
Okay. Let's just change topics real quick here in the last couple minutes. You've been given credit for getting Park City leaders together with the owners of Treasure, and you had hoped that if Treasure was developed, the Institute may find a home there. Now, with the announcement of no development, as long as we pass that bond in November, what does that mean for the Institute here?
Well, the Institute is as it ever was. It doesn't change anything. We've been looking for something that would be more a home of our own for probably 10 years now. We have expanded our programming, and we love being in the Eccles Center. We find more and more that the people we bring in are also looking for more intimate opportunities to have discussions and a kind of artist-in-residence program that was so successful in its very, very small way at Silver Star that Rory Murphy did some years ago with others. And so that's really what we're looking to do. We're looking to have a space specifically in nature that feels like a retreat center. We've had some other offers within the county over the past 4 or 5 years, and we have other offers that we're looking at right now. It's not something that there's any time frame to. It's something that is a wish, and it would be great if it worked. I felt that I was in a unique position in this past summer when I heard Adam Strong's report on the radio saying that he would sign on for another 6 months of planning commission, but it was taking him away from his family and his work, and it broke my heart. And I thought, what if there could be a good outcome to this? I felt like there was a new regime in the city hall. I knew the Sweeneys from 86, you know, from the 80s. I had written a piece in the Park Record about do we trade the density for the open space in 86? It's a piece that both sides still use in legal documents. And, you know, there were trade-offs. We got the Sweeney switchbacks, but we gave them the density. I had met Liz Rad once at a dinner in 06, and so I decided that I would try and find a way to contact Liz and start with her. And I spent several months developing a relationship with her, with working with the Sweeneys. There had been some issues with their conversations, so I tried to help there. You know, Jack Thomas, I've known since the 70s, great guy, and he was in a position to after a couple of meetings, to entertain this as well. This was, everybody was pretty entrenched in where they were, and I'm pretty happy that we got to what could be idyllic solution.
Yeah. So in terms of your dream home, I mean, what does that look like?
Well, it's never meant to be a performance space. And when all of this was getting, you know, out of proportion, I just stayed out of it because I didn't want to be another topic. But it's meant to be a combination of the Aspen Institute, the rehearsal hall at Sundance, a flavor of the Santa Fe Institute, and something that would be uniquely Park City. So a think tank, great room. I think rehearsal hall at Sundance is, you know, the best example of physically what it could look like. But what happens in there would be something different.
With some lodging as well? I mean, is that what you would want?
Not necessarily. I mean, one of the things when they were talking about the 100-bed hotel, that was a logical extension. But no, I think that there's plenty of lodging in Park City and Summit County if we found the right space and you were, you know, maybe taking people there in some kind of shuttle system so that they are a little out of their elements, which I've been to some retreat centers and had that great experience, and I'd love for Park City to be able to offer that as well.
Well, how much space do you need?
You know, that's I'm learning. I'm not an architect. So the rehearsal hall at Sundance, I think, is about 4,500 square feet. That seems like an interesting size, but I don't really know.
Yeah. And if Sundance Institute moves, then there's space over at Silver Star. Is that a possibility?
You know, it's an interesting space, but it isn't as remote as I would like to see. So I want people to really feel that they are in the middle of the woods somewhere.
Okay. All right, need to leave it there. Terry, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie.